Storyworthy Media, the best in story-driven content.
Hi, it's Mike Bonifer, and you're listening to Storyworthy. Is that right?
Welcome to the Storyworthy Podcast. Here are your hosts, Christine Blackburn and Hannes Finn.
Welcome to Storyworthy. My name is Christine Blackburn, and I'm here with
Hannes Finney, and we're coming to you from Evanston, Illinois.
Evanston,
the birthplace of Bill Murray.
Oh, okay. I should have known that.
You should have known that.
Yeah.
Also the home of Northwestern University, which, so far as I know, has nothing to do with Bill Murray, so we'll just forget that.
Bill Murray. All right, you guys. We're talking about Bill Murray tonight because our guest, Mike Bonifer, he brings forth the topic, Finding Bill Murray.
Yes, and this is, like,
I didn't know he was lost.
Well, I think people love, I don't know, there's a whole website devoted to Bill Murray stories.
Yeah.
Which is like stories of you meeting Bill Murray or doing weird things or having an odd picture of him covered in cake or you ran into him somewhere. He's just one of these guys that people just gravitate towards. And, like, you know, they'll be like cell phone footage of him happening to come upon a like bachelor, not a bachelor party, but like a bachelor dinner somewhere, and he'll suddenly walk into a room of people that he's never met before.
I see.
And start giving the guy advice.
I see. About, that's really funny.
About life.
So in other words, he's not like a typical movie star whatsoever.
I had some. There's something weird about him.
I don't think he lives
him.
In
he's L.A. A, you know, I think he might be a sage.
What's a sage?
Well, if you don't know what a sage is.
I don't.
I'm saying like a person who gives advice to the general world. People look toward, whether they should or not, I don't know, because I've never met Bill Murray.
Yeah.
But people are like just, and I love old guys that young people are fascinated by.
Well, Bill Murray's only 65. He was
born
in 50.
Yeah, but if you're 20, you think he's really old.
I see. I don't think he's old.
That's because we're 100.
That's true. Well, here's what I know about Bill Murray. He was the first guest that David Letterman ever had on his show in 1982.
Yeah, I watched that show.
And then he was the final guest in May of this year,
2015. Well, he was also the first guest of the Late Show.
Oh,
so
okay.
So he was first guest of the first show. He was first guest of the Late Show, and he's the last guest of the Late Show as well.
Interesting.
Which is just amazing to think that somebody... That's the other thing about a guy like that is longevity.
Yeah.
Like, he was famous enough to be the first guest. 35 years later, he was famous enough...
He's still relative.
There could have been a whole bunch of stuff in between where somebody just completely falls out of.
Well, and then when we
eye.
Talk about his movies, especially the first movie, Meatballs, it still totally holds up. That movie from 1979. It's a very funny movie. And it kind of, I think that's where they got the inspiration for Wet Hot American Summer, the new movie that the new
show that's
out. I
don't know why I'm proud of this, but I've never seen Wet Hot American Summer. I don't like it just because the title is too spot on.
I see.
Do you know what I mean?
No, because
like,
it's really
a wet,
it's
hot
very...
American summer. It's like, it's just stop it.
No, it's very funny, though. It's very much like a Meatballs.
People have told me that. But you know what? I love Bill Murray, but I wasn't that crazy about Meatballs.
Oh, I like Meatballs. And then, of course, Caddyshack was ridiculously amazing. Also in 1980, it seems like I was in junior high school, but it was just like Caddyshack was so risky. Like it was so it was so risque. It was so, you know, really great.
Well, you know what I say to that? It's in the hole.
Yeah.
I just, anytime
anything movie.
Falls in a hole, I still say that, and people still laugh. Well, if we're talking about Bill Murray, I would say he is one of the, I consider... In one of the greatest movies ever made, Groundhog Day.
Yeah.
I think Groundhog Day has depth to it that is, we still haven't really plummeted. Really does. It is.
I have a hard time with Annie McDowell, though, just to be honest with you. I don't know. I don't really care for her as an actress, and so that kind of stops me up there.
You know, I know what you mean, although I don't mind her. Although you did like her with Rosie O'Donnell.
Well, that's what I always think about.
My Sister Rides the Bus,
riding the bus with my sister. That's what I think about.
Rosie O'Donnell played a mentally challenged woman.
If I see Annie McDowell, I can't stop thinking about how bad she was in that movie with Rosie O'Donnell, which was like so bad it was classic. So therefore, I get tripped up.
See, you're making me think of a problem I have, which is I have a problem with Audrey Hepburn, which seems crazy. But Audrey Hepburn is in several of my favorite movies, and yet I don't like her. It doesn't make any sense.
And what? It doesn't make
any
sense.
She's in Charade, which stars Cary Grant, and I love Cary Grant.
This is podcasting gold.
This is podcast. This is where the kids get drawn in right here. They love a good Cary Grant reference. Also, she's in Sabrina.
Yeah.
With Humphrey Bogart, who I love, and yet the whole I'll be watching it, and I'll be like, oh, she irritates me. I'm still watching this movie. I've watched it 100 times. It's weird.
Yeah.
So she is your Audrey Hepburn.
Perhaps. All right, let's move on. How about what about Bob? That was one of the funniest movies I've ever seen.
I only saw that once. I guess I didn't love that as much as maybe, and this will sound, put a serious note on it, because it was about mental illness and my brother's mentally ill. It couldn't be quite as funny to me. Because I've actually been around people like that.
Yeah, I see.
Do you know what I mean?
That,
like,
it was
too
hilarious.
Much like, okay, you know, I mean,
well,
I'm not saying you can't make fun of it. I'm saying I don't want to watch it.
And now here's, I'm probably going to get thrown right out of here, but I didn't think Ghostbusters was that funny.
Well, you're obviously a communist of some kinds. Ghostbusters is great. Ghostbusters 2,
I don't know.
But Ghostbusters is also a but you know what the problem is? Not that it's not that funny. It's that's not your kind of movie.
It's not my kind of movie.
You didn't like horror, any sort of
sci-fi.
I don't like sci-fi.
Star
you don't like
Wars.
Sci-fi.
I don't like Harry Potter.
You don't like anything with ray guns.
I don't like anything that isn't going to happen. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Here's what I loved. I loved Lost in Translation. That was just a beautiful movie from top to bottom. The music was fantastic. The city was fantastic. You know who? The actress Scarlett Johansson was fantastic. So that I loved. And then more recently, I just saw him in St. Vincent with Melissa McCarthy. And that was good. I didn't love it, but I liked it.
But this is podcast gold because we're going to talk about a movie that 5 people saw last year. St. Vincent. He was good. I thought some of it, I thought they must have reshot the ending.
Yeah.
Because I was like really, you know, enjoying it. He individually, great. Melissa McCarthy, she was great. And then, actually, who else was it? The woman, the girl, his stripper girlfriend.
I can't recall.
She's Australian, but she was playing Russian. Anyhow, you can edit all this out. Anyhow, at the end, he becomes the subject of the boys' like presentation of a hero or something.
Mm-hmm.
And he walks into a room, and the entire room erupts into applause.
Right.
And I hate when movies, when we're being shown as an audience, another audience applauding the character, as in, you should be applauding this character, too.
Yeah.
Because look at these people. Watch them applaud. It's like, no.
Nobody in our theater started applauding.
No, I'm not saying that. I'm saying they're desperately trying to get you to be excited.
I understand.
Besides,
listen, that's
my
problem.
5 people in your theater.
That's my problem with all those Disney movies with the music underneath, because the music is telling you how to feel, and I hate that. So I know what you're saying. Here's what I know.
You hate Disney. You hate Ghostbusters. You're a horrible person.
I don't mean to say hate. That's a strong word. But
you hate
don't,
Disney.
Don't,
no.
Okay,
don't,
I do.
You hate Disney.
I do.
I know you hate Disney. And it drives you crazy that your daughter wanted to be one of those two stupid snow princesses.
That didn't drive me crazy. I could care less. It was
cute. You were pissed. You have been trying so hard to keep Disney away from your child, and it came in like a virus.
Oh, my gosh.
A frozen virus.
And she couldn't let it go. All right, listen, here's what I know about Bill Murray. On his 20th birthday, the police arrested him at Chicago's O'Hare Airport for trying to smuggle marijuana. How much was he trying to smuggle, Hannes? Was it 1 pound, 5 pounds, or 10 pounds of cannabis?
I don't know. 1 pound.
10 pounds.
Oh, so he really was trying to smuggle it.
Definitely with the intent to sell. That's a lot of marijuana. 10 pounds. I mean, I'm just saying.
Yeah, but that's in the old days. You needed 5 pounds just to get
less.
High.
No, I don't care.
Nowadays.
Yeah, it was when grass was really grass.
You're the one that's refined. Yeah, he was 10 pounds of sod that he was trying to get through O'Hare Airport.
He had Roundup in the other hand.
Yeah.
I thought that was sort of interesting, though. But, yeah, again, we talk about 45 years ago. Let that go.
No, actually, it's interesting because he's like this – he has a like reputation as being this sort of like mystical person. But he has 3 brothers who are all in show business, and the reputation doesn't – hit them at all.
Who are his
brothers? Doyle Murray is his older brother. You have seen him a million times. He was the mayor in Groundhog Day.
Okay.
He was the head caddy in Caddyshack.
Oh, yeah.
He has a brother who was on Mad Men.
Boy, Hannes, that's good information. I didn't know anything about that.
Yeah, yeah. No, it's like the whole family is very much Chicago-based, which I do enjoy that.
Yeah, well, we're going to find out why Mike Bonifer was looking for him, what he was
looking
for.
Why did he find him?
But listen,
he looked for him and found him.
About Mike Bonifer.
He's not like you, who never found Bill Murray. Never had a dinner.
By the way, I don't think it's that hard to get a hold of celebrities anymore. I mean, you can Twitter them. You can Facebook them. I'm not saying they're going
to
respond.
No, it used to be.
But there is a more clear way to go.
Maybe
you don't have to go through a publicist.
Maybe this will be part of the story, but it's like Bill Murray, he's famously, like, normal ways for people in show business to get to him are not how you get to him.
I see.
You don't just call his agent. You have to call, like, an 800 number or something. It's very... You know, it's probably
maybe that was the way it was, but now with social media,
you
I'm sure Bill Murray.
Remember Leon Redbone?
No.
Okay. Leon Redbone was a musician in the 70s. He famously, the only way you could call him, you would call like a diner, and if he was there, they could call him to the phone.
That's really humorous.
Yes.
That's very funny. You know, that was always like a big deal if you were like at the Beverly Hills Hotel or one of those fancy hotels, they say, in the 50s and 60s, and they'd be like, Elizabeth Taylor, you have a phone call at the gate. Elizabeth Taylor, phone call at the gate.
Yeah,
and then that would be
just
a big deal.
People
like,
would page themselves
somebody,
to make them see them.
Somebody needs to talk to her like right now? What could it be? It's exciting.
This is Richard Button. I need you right now. By the way, now this is getting even lower response than my previous joke, a bad Richard Burton impression.
All right.
Nobody out there in podcast.
You guys, look, we're going to bring our guest on in just a minute, by the way. Mike Bonifer, an interesting guy, Hannes. He's written a couple of books. He knows a lot. He's very bright.
And his name is Bonifer, which is easy to spell and yet unusual.
I like that name. He's a CEO and the co-founder of Big Story. It's a company that takes storytelling into other companies to help them structure their business, and I know I'm saying it wrong, and he's going to define it for me.
No, but you were using hand gestures, and those...
Yeah, well, podcast gold.
Yeah, exactly.
But before we bring on our guest, I did want to mention that if you'd like to support the Storyworthy podcast, that would be great. Here's what you can do. Buy my book, Pit to LAX, My Storyworthy Life. If you head on over to storyworthymedia.com, you'll see the banner for the book, and it's only $10, and I'll sign it for you. This is where you really get your
this
money's worth.
You're not like Bill Murray hiding behind a diner.
I will sit at my dining room table, and the request will come in for the book, and I will sign it for you, and then you will have it.
It's so easy to get a hold of us.
It's so easy. You could also follow us on Twitter at Storyworthy and Instagram at Storyworthy. And you know what, Hannes? I wanted to read real quick a nice little note that we got the other day from a fan.
Mm-hmm.
Can I read this?
Yeah, please.
Dear Christine, I've been listening to your podcast for about 3 years now, and it quickly rose to the top of my short list of favorite podcasts. Others have come and gone from my iTunes favorites playlist, but Storyworthy remains. People and their stories are great, but where the show shines is when you talk with them afterwards. You have a talent for making your guests feel comfortable and getting them to open up and just be themselves. Podcast gold, ladies and gentlemen.
Yes, it's become
from JD in Santa Rosa. Isn't that a nice note?
That is a nice note. It's much nicer than the reviews we usually get where it's like, everything's great except Christine and Hannes. He's an asshole, and her voice is grating.
You know what? That's not true. We don't get
positive reviews now. But that was thank you, JD.
Thank you for emailing
us.
You can always email us at info@storyworthypodcast.com. And you know, we also have a mailing list now, and that's easy enough to join.
Because we're surging forward.
But there's nothing wrong with getting a very short email from me on Monday
emailing
mornings.
List.
It's an email. It's
yes.
all good.
It's not a physical
snail
mail.
You can join
mail
that
list.
Over at Storyworthy Podcast as well, storyworthypodcast.com. All right, you guys, whoever you are, stick around because our guest today, Mike Bonifer, is on his way here. Next time on Storyworthy, we have writer and comedian Sabrina Cognata.
I'll be talking about human secretions and bodily fluids.
That's next time on Storyworthy. Hey, Christine, tell everybody about our social media consulting business.
Well, Hannes, we have learned so much over the last 5 years doing Storyworthy about social media, and we've had so many guests on the show that have given us their tips and ideas.
Yeah.
And so now we are sharing our experience with others. Started a new social media consulting business, and if you email us at info@storyworthypodcast.com, I'll be happy to fill you in on exactly what we're able to do for you.
Yeah, we can increase your social media footprint.
Exactly.
Footprint.
Exactly.
Footprint!
Again, email us over at info@storyworthypodcast.com, and I'll be happy to email you a rate sheet.
it's Naomi Grossman, Pepper from American Horror Story Asylum, and you're listening to Storyworthy.
And we're back. We have left Evanston. We've gone into the city of Chicago, and we are now at the Second City, the famous Second City, where many people, including Bill Murray, but many others, have studied and become comedy legends.
All right. You guys, he's here right now, Mike Bonifer. He is the CEO and co-founder of Big Story. And here's how I'm going to describe it to you. You ready?
Okay.
Because this is how it is on the website.
Got
so
it.
If this doesn't explain it, then there's no explaining.
Yeah, exactly.
It's the first company in the world to offer a commercial application of quantum storytelling, the science of how stories live in the world, influence behaviors, and shape the future.
Okay.
Did you get it?
I got it. You used the word quantum.
He's also an author, and he has a book, Game Changers, out, which is improvisation for business in the networked world. So Game Changers, he talks about different games that you can play. He's very improv.
Yeah, he's actually
oriented.
Meaning game. He doesn't mean like, it's a game changer.
No, he's talking about
the iPhone 6.
Literally games. He also has a new book out called Control Shift that he wrote along with Jesse Sternschniss. And that book is 50 games for 50 fucking days like today. Again, with the storytelling and the game. So
it's
really exciting.
Storytelling.
It's super fun. You can find Mike over at bigstorybiz.com. And he's even going to give you his email address, which is mike@bigstory.biz. How about that?
Mm-hmm.
And you can follow him on Twitter @Bonifer. All right, you guys, wherever you are, put your hands together for Mike Bonifer.
Thank you, thank you, thank you. The story begins on a farm in Indiana where I grew up. My father collected horses that other people didn't want. We had a farm full of cast-off horses that had issues. Horses with one leg shorter than the other, horses with one lung, horses with albino eyes and sway backs and biting problems. He was determined to rescue and rehabilitate horses. And little by little, over the time that I grew up there, our farm turned into a theme park built around these rehabilitated horses, Cloverleaf Park and Riding Stable. And it was one hell of a way to grow up, let me tell you. So flash forward 25 years, and I'm out in L.A., and I'm going through a series of crises in my life that challenged me on every level, financially, emotionally, personally, professionally. I was deeply challenged. And I felt as if I only had one thing, aside from my children, I only had one thing of value left in my life. And that was the story that I was born to tell, the story of my father and his horses and how we grew up on this farm that turned into a theme park and how he was a farmer who dreamed of being a cowboy. So I decided that I would tell this story. I called it The Legend of Cowboy Bob. I wrote it as a screenplay. I wrote it 11 times. And it turned into a beautiful screenplay. There is a lot of material. There's probably enough material to make 5 movies. So it turned into 11 screenplays, different variations. And quite a few people were interested in buying the screenplay. I was in L.A., super focused on this story. But I insisted that Bill Murray have the right of first refusal to play Cowboy Bob. The reason being that in the mid-80s, when he had made the film The Razor's Edge, I was sent to New York by Columbia Pictures to interview Bill Murray. And so we spent the morning on the roof of his penthouse apartment on the Upper West Side, drinking Löwenbräus and talking and shooting the shit. And the interview was a very small part of it. It was a wonderful experience, about like you think it would be, meeting Bill Murray and hanging out and shooting the shit and talking about Belushi, who had died not long before, and talking about Ghostbusters and talking about doing one for yourself and one for the studio and talking about fame and the price of fame. And he is a wise man. He has a lot of wisdom, and he's lived and seen a lot, and so it was fun to talk about it and drink some beer and crack up over the way he looked, which was he's wearing on a hot day corduroy pants with little red lobsters printed on him and mismatched airline booties and a sweater and the thickest beard you've ever seen him in, and you're going, hell, somewhere in there is Bill Murray. It's awesome. But the most profound thing about it was he's the only person that I've ever met in my life that reminded me of my father. And it didn't have as much to do with physical resemblance as it had to do with a, I would call it a vibration. They vibrated at the same unique frequency. And I got the feeling in his presence that I got being around my dad, who was this totally unique character. So when the screenplay was finished, people wanted to buy it. And I said, no, Bill has to see it. And he gets to decide whether he wants to play this character because I wrote it with him in mind. For 7 weeks, the whole apparatus as I knew it in Hollywood, including agencies and managers and producers, were trying to find Bill Murray. None of them could do it, and I was going increasingly crazy because now I didn't have this writing to do anymore. I had no focus. And finally, after 7 weeks of this, I said, forget it, quit looking, call off the search, I'll find him myself. I got in the car, in my car, with a video camera, and I started driving. I drove across the United States and back, and every single person I met along the way, I asked them on camera if they had seen Bill Murray. I was headed to what I would call a number of touchstones along the way. So I had friends to visit. I had places that I knew Bill had been in the past. I wasn't looking for him. I wasn't going and going, well, he's likely to be in a certain place, or I have an address, or there's an 800 number. I was invoking the spirit of Bill Murray. So Regis College in Denver, Wrigley Field, but also a lot of friends along the way, a jazz drummer from living in Downers Grove who went with me and his two young daughters to Wrigley Field. And it was, in a weird way, it was therapeutic to me, and it was a way for me to get my footing again in life and find my focus. And my friend in Chicago in particular, after we had come back from a day at Wrigley Field where I'm asking all these drunken people, it was a doubleheader with the Brewers, and I'm asking people if they'd seen Bill Murray, and I had a whole setup for it, Bill Murray, Bill Murray, and, you know, an amazing number of people had seen him, of course, around Wrigley Field, and they're all doing their shtick about Bill Murray. And my friend and I are sitting that night in his basement, and he's playing the drums, and he's talking about drumming and his start, and he's talking about our friendship. And he goes, you know, I was watching you out there today while you were doing that. And he goes, I don't think there's anything else you could be doing right now. I think it's the perfect thing for you to be doing. So I got a lot of affirmation along the way. And I got to New York. I picked up a friend from college in Chicago, and we made a road trip out of it to go to New York, where we asked people in the street corner if they had seen Bill Murray. And again, lots of interesting stories. People wanted to be part of the quest. People would offer to cook for Bill if Bill showed up. People would volunteer to be in the movie. There were all kinds of beautiful things that happened. And my friend and I were headed to New Canaan, Connecticut, where a buddy of ours from college named Pete Demmerle, who was the golden boy when we were in college, he was a Rhodes Scholar, he was an All-American football player at Notre Dame, he had ALS. He was dying of ALS. He had lost the power to speak. And so we got to this beautiful home, this Cape Cod home in New Canaan, and for a while we thought we were at the wrong address because there was no answer. And I went back to check my notes, and I said, I think this is where Pete lives. And all of a sudden, we saw a shadow move in front of the window, and you go, holy shit, that is Pete Demmerle. That's the golden boy, and he's got a walker, and he couldn't talk to us. He had to guide us back into his den, and then he's gesturing, and we're sort of guessing what he wants. Do you want us to set up the chessboard? Do you want us to turn on the TV? What do you want? What do you want? And we finally figured out he wanted his voice synthesizer. And I'm really there to ask him if he had seen Bill Murray and catch up with him. So he taps out a message on his voice synthesizer, and he hits send, and the voice says, who will wipe my ass? And that was all we needed to have the greatest time that I ever had with Pete Demmerle. We actually thought he was going to die laughing. He was on a ventilator, and for a minute, he was laughing so hard and drooling, and he was literally dying. And my friend said later, I wish he would have died laughing. Oh, I wish he would have died laughing. Because we were dying laughing. It was the most joyous, carefree, no holds barred laughter, and it was mostly shit jokes. It was mostly just stuff that he was wrestling with, and you know, well, sweet corn season isn't as good as it used to be for Pete, and you know, everything was. It was really amazing, and so things like that happened all along the way, and I got back to Los Angeles. 3 or 4 weeks later, and I had this vast compilation of footage, hundreds of short interviews I had done where I had asked people if they had seen Bill Murray. And I cut it together into a 10-minute highlights reel, and I started showing that to people in the industry, and I would videotape them while they were watching it, and then I would ask them, after they had watched it, are you going to help me find Bill Murray? And people were really inspired by the journey, by the quest, and so they began helping me. And the path eventually led to Bill's youngest brother, Joel. Someone knew Joel. And I'm showing this to Joel's friends, and they're going, yeah, we'll get it to Joel. So I show the 10 minutes to Joel. And Joel and his wife, Eliza, were there watching it. And at a certain point, my dad, I had stopped on our farm, and my dad was in the video. And Eliza goes, that's the guy that could convince him right there. And I go, well, of course, because they're the same guy. They're kindred spirits. You know, of course my dad could convince him. But my dad's not going to come out to L.A., so we have to convince him. So Joel agreed to help me get the screenplay, get the project in front of Bill. There was, however, a price of admission, because I am far from the only person that has approached Joel Murray and said, hey, can I get something to Bill? And Joel joked about that, like, oh, nobody ever gives me things to take to Bill. But he read the script, and he liked it, and he had an idea for a screenplay that he wanted me to write with him. So we spent 3 mornings a week for 6 weeks writing this script, which is about a junior high basketball team from Chicago, an idea that Joel had. And throughout that process, Bill was lurking. Bill was like a ghost. Bill was like Gatto in the play Waiting for Gatto. He was there. He was present. So Joel would get a phone call, and it would be Bill. And he'd go, just a second, I got to leave the room. And I'd hear him in the next room, and he'd be going, yeah, he's here. Yeah, he's here. No, he's a nice guy. No, you should meet him. And he was just always slightly out of reach. And so this kept going on, and we got the screenplay finished. It was a good screenplay. It was called Rebound. I don't know if anything will ever happen to it, but it was a good process, and Joel and I became friends. And it finally came to a weekend where Joel and Bill were going to play golf together, and Joel goes, this is it. This is the time. So Bill has a ranch down south of Los Angeles, and they were going to hang out there, and they were going to play golf at this club nearby for the whole weekend. So I outfitted Joel with, I got my dad to send out one of his cowboy hats. And I had a copy of the screenplay, and I gave him one of my cameras. And I said, give Bill the screenplay. If he agrees to play Cowboy Bob, he's to indicate that by putting on the hat. Get the video. That's the contract of Bill wearing my dad's hat. That will be our contract. So now I'm waiting 48 hours of tension, of like all of it has come to this. All of this quest has come down to this weekend and Joel playing golf with Bill. He came back on Monday. I was in there and he goes, well, it's sort of a mixed bag. And I go, what do you mean? And he goes, well, when he wasn't playing golf, he was sleeping. He came back and, you know, we had drinks on the 19th hole, and then he'd come back and he'd go right to sleep. So the only time that we were here, he was sleeping. And I didn't have a chance until I was leaving and I was putting my clubs in the trunk of the car, and Bill saw your dad's cowboy hat and he goes, what's this? And I had to explain the whole thing right at the end, right as I was leaving. And he goes, Bill took the hat and he put it on and it fit perfectly. That surprised me because I thought Bill had a bigger head than your dad did. I thought the hat would be too small, but it fit him perfectly. But I didn't take the video camera. It was just not the right time to do it. However, one day when Bill was sleeping, I went out to the corral, and he goes, I think you'll be interested in the footage. So he handed over this video to me, and he showed me Bill's horses, and they were the spitting image of my dad's horses. albino-eyed horses, swayback mares with half a tail, miniature mules, and all. They could have been right out of our corral when I was growing up. So that was the footage I had. So I go, well, Bill has actually been Cowboy Bob all along. And as Joel and I were working on this screenplay, I began assembling my dad's story because a film critic and commentator named Jeffrey Wells had looked at the 10 minutes. And he said, you're not explaining why you're looking. Like, what is at the heart of your quest? What's so important about you finding Bill Murray? You talk about it, but we're not seeing it in this. And I realized, oh, I actually have to go back and spend time on the farm and interview my dad and my family. And at the center of this was the amazing story of how we grew up. I mean, I have just touched on it. And so I captured that. And so I made a documentary called Finding Bill Murray that was me telling Bill my dad's story in an effort to get Bill to be in a story about my dad. And we showed it projected on the side of our barn a week before my dad died to 200 family and friends at Magic Hour. It was the most beautiful thing that has ever happened to me in my life. And I had my camera because I wanted to shoot this tableau in front of me, and it took immense physical effort to even raise the camera because I was transfixed, because I was going, this is it. This was the destination all along. This is what it was meant to be. I was never meant to find Bill Murray. This is what I was meant to find. I was meant to spend the last 2 years of my dad's life talking to him. I was meant to get these people together. I was meant to pay this homage to my father. And I told the story, which is really what I wanted to do all along. And that was the end of the quest. I never had to find Bill Murray because, as it turns out, he was fully present. He was a participant in the game. And as we say in improv, don't solve the problem, and the game will keep on. So it has been the outcomes. I always talk in our work about the difference between an objective and the outcomes. And I'll say the objective is your point of focus, but the outcome is where the money is. And so I discovered all these amazing outcomes along the way. People hired me for work because they were inspired by this quest. I got far more work than if I had sold the screenplay, made way more money than if I had sold the screenplay. Joel and I are still friends. My son picked up improv along the way, and he and I do a two-person show. Joel's son, Hank, is starting with improv. He's really good. We've talked about doing a fathers and sons show, a one-hour block of fathers and sons with some other people whose kids do improv. And there's been interest lately about the screenplay that Joel and I wrote together. So all of these amazing things happened, and that's the story.
That is awesome. See?
That's a great story. You know what? It's so interesting. I think the lesson learned is that you never know what's going to lead to what.
And you never know.
And so the idea of the legend of Cowboy Bob wasn't ever supposed to be just that. It was more than that. So it's layers of it.
Right.
Yeah. And it's like that's the one of those Bill Murray stories. It's like there's something about that guy that inspires things to happen. He doesn't even have to be there. Just the idea that he might be there.
Yeah.
You know, it's amazing. I actually looked up, remember I said sage and I didn't have the actual, it's like, yeah, he is a sage is in classical philosophy someone who's attained the wisdom which a philosopher seeks.
Interesting.
Like that's what, like, I don't even know if Bill Murray has it, but people think that he knows something that we should know. Like his approval is something that people
so
want.
So is your dad's name, was his name Bob?
Yes.
It was Robert Bonifer?
Robert Lee Bonifer, yes.
Robert Lee, wow, that's interesting.
My mom's name still is Fern. She's still back there. My dad passed away.
That's a beautiful name, Fern.
Ago. Bob and Fern. I always thought of it as a verb. We're going to go Bob and Fern in the back 40.
Is your mom still on the farm?
She's still on the farm. I just saw her the week before last. She's going strong.
Now,
she's
tell me how many people help her. What's on the farm anymore?
She rents the land. It's a 200-acre farm. And there are still four horses there, which nobody really touches because that was my dad's thing. But my sister and her husband built a house.
Oh, how nice.
About a quarter of a mile from my mom. And they sold a plot of land. They sold off 10 acres. So my mom has neighbors. Now, nice. Five homes on 2-acre right. plots, yeah. beautiful homes. It drives me crazy. I don't like it because I go, wow. there's supposed to be a bean field there, all right? You
wow.
know, there's supposed to be. It's ruined. And my mom loves having neighbors.
I don't blame her.
I don't blame
Who
her
Who wants to be isolated?
No, it
she's
was pretty,
88. That's
yeah,
great.
She's 88 and going super strong. Loves to. She won $900 playing bingo when we went with her to the bingo.
That's a lot of money. Seriously?
She was
raking
it in.
How many cards does she play at a time?
She plays 15 cards at a time.
15 cards at a time.
And she's correcting my three cards when we're playing the
Cubbo.
She's going, you missed in the O's, 71.
So she's like three rows of five.
Three rows of five.
And then does she have those little.
Just a machine. Boom, boom, boom.
Does she have those? Oh, she uses a dauber.
Yeah, no, she doesn't use the stacked. Things that they do.
There's she's like a dauber.
We're
like
a dobbing family.
Yeah, sure. Well, sure.
We're daubers.
And yeah. so does she have like those little tiny statues that you keep up while you play bingo, you know, for good luck, that kind of
no,
thing?
No, no, she's not. She actually gets her good luck from my dad who shines down on her because
aww.
She never got to play bingo when we were on the farm. And so now that she's got time, leisure time, not taking care of my dad and his crazy schemes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
She has good luck all over the place.
And so the four horses that remain, are they all old? And
they're middle-aged, I would say.
Are
they're,
you a horse okay. guy?
No, I'm not. I was the oldest of six. I had the burden of these horses thrust upon me at an early age.
Yeah.
When you have to wear your cowboy hat and string tie and cowboy boots to school to yeah. promote Cloverleaf Park and Riding Stable.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
there's a bunch of farmers and farmers' kids on the bus waiting for
yeah.
you to question what all this is, and local people clearly think your dad is a fool. It was not much fun.
Well, it is a huge, crazy ambition to have an amusement park or a theme park around disabled horses.
They were, and we were in the middle of nowhere. We were on a gravel road.
How much was admission?
It was $3.50, and we had a half-mile track with an arena in the infield. We had a softball field,
basketball court. What did you do in the arena?
We had different events every weekend in the summer, so we had all-comers
track. I would have gone to this in a second. If I were driving to the street yeah. and I heard about that, I'd be like, yeah. no, we're going.
We're there.
We are going.
Yeah,
did
you couldn't have found it. Okay,
yeah.
the directions
yeah.
were turn off Highway 231 and follow the signs.
Was there any beverages or food?
Oh, yeah, but mostly we gave it away to friends and family. I mean, it was just not a money-making thing, but, you know, people would give it away. Cousins would come in and win all the bicycle racing trophies, and so the people that showed up to really race would lose to family. And,
yeah.
When
it was all of that.
That your Bill Murray was the guy to play your father. How do you mean? I mean, did your father remind people of Bill Murray, or is it just
oh, no.
that he could inspire or he could fulfill? What was your father really like? What would people say about him?
Well,
that he was a dreamer. That he was
yes.
crazy.
He was a dreamer with. A serious focus and a serious love of horses. And I believe that his theory was that anybody can love a good horse. It takes a real horse lover to love the horses that he had.
Yeah.
So
I wonder what his parents were like, because there's some sort of education going on there.
So here's what it was. I found out after he died.
Mm-hmm.
And in terms of the quantum storytelling and the work we do today, there's a process called restorying that some of the quantum storytellers are using with veterans to help them recover from PTSD.
Yeah.
So he had PTSD. They called it shell shock after World War II.
Mm-hmm.
And he never talked about the war.
Where was he in the war? What was his role?
In Europe. And he was a corporal, and he was a sharpshooter, and he was behind enemy lines. And
oh,
he had
so
a
he
box
saw
full of
fighting.
Medals.
Wow.
Well, listen to what he saw. And this explained the horses. But nobody knew this because he never talked about it.
Yeah. None of those guys, those World War II guys, they didn't talk about this stuff.
Yeah.
No.
Yeah.
There is no way to share the experience with someone who hasn't been through it.
Sure, sure.
In particular, what he went through. So the first thing that happened was there were 200 men in his unit, his regiment. A full regiment is 220. And I found this out. We tracked down, about 3 years ago, we tracked down the radio man mm-hmm. in his unit, a man named Jerome Blesch, who was back in Indiana, still alive, was 92 years old at the time, and had a stroke. So his speech was a little slurred, but he was extremely cogent, and he remembered all of it. So the first thing was 200 people in a regiment on a bridge called the Moselle Bridge. Three German tanks had eluded Patton's army when they swept through chasing Nazis, and they waited in ambush, and they ambushed the regiment on the bridge, and only 60 of the soldiers survived.
Wow.
So you can imagine what the chaos was on that bridge when basically an enemy that you can't see because it's in hiding just unloads with three tanks and whatever men they've got. It was a massacre.
Yeah.
And they kept going after that massacre, the 60 and whatever they added to it, and they came to a small town in Germany, and there was a big factory up behind the town that wasn't on any of the maps and in any of the intel. And so my father and went up with the platoon, and the radio man, Blesch, was along. They came upon this, in front of this factory, a tall wire fence with what Mr. Blesch said was 1,000 living skeletons standing behind it. It was Buchenwald.
Mm-hmm. No kidding.
And nobody had told them anything
they
about that, any of this.
They came upon a concentration camp.
Yeah, they had no information.
They didn't know what it was. And he said, we cut them out from behind the fence, and many of them spoke perfect English. And even as they were describing it to us, we could not figure out what it was. It didn't make any sense. And then you saw it was 800 acres. Mm-hmm. So corpses piled up. All the horses had been eaten. They were using slaves to pull wagons loaded with corpses. They had to spend 2 nights in Buchenwald until the command got in and figured out what to do about it, what to make of it, what it was, all of this. They had to sit there with all of that death. And then the final thing was, according to Mr. Blesch, is they rode through another German town after that, and all the horses that were left in the town had been lined up by Patton's troops in the town square and shot through the head, and the women were butchering the horses for food.
For food. Oh, my gosh.
So when he said that, everything sort of fell into place.
Yeah.
I flashed back through every horse that we ever rescued and every sentiment my father ever expressed about a horse and everything that he ever said, things like, a horse will give you back what you put into it. If you show a horse love, it will give you love in return.
But this
and
is the
all of that.
This is the screenplay, right?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes.
I mean,
the screenplay. Oh, there is so much to the screenplay, Christine and Hannes. You wouldn't believe it. The theme park is just the setting.
Yeah.
Have you thought of making it a novel?
I have. I've thought of – I continue to tell the story. I was the featured storyteller at the San Miguel International Storytelling Festival in Mexico last year, mm-hmm. and I told a 45-minute version of mm-hmm. the story. I tell it sometimes.
So why don't you get it on paper in terms of, like, you know, they have those translators now, and you can translate it right into, you know, spit it out.
Oh, the novel?
Yeah, spit it out.
Yeah, no, I think it's something, it's a touchstone for me, so I can tell it whenever I need to tell it. It's mm-hmm. my magic.
But in terms of, I mean, I'm talking about a feature film. I'm yeah. seeing Brad Pitt.
Well, there's actually somebody that wants to take it to Tom Hanks now, because now I'm absolved of any, you know, given that I completed my journey,
yeah.
Bill or
isn't
no
that
Bill,
beautiful?
It doesn't
yeah.
matter.
Now it's
yeah,
just business.
Very, I'm
now
very detached.
That's
it could
lovely.
Be business. So
good
somebody approached me about
Tom Hanks does seem like that's in his wheelhouse.
Yeah, and he has gained gravitas since this happened. I
yeah.
thought at the time, and I actually was working with Tom Hanks. I have another story about Toy Story where Tim Allen was an asshole to me about the whole thing, where mm-hmm. Tim Allen sussed out that I had this story, and I actually was thinking more of Tim Allen because I thought Tom, I had worked with Tom on Splash and then on Toy Story, and I thought he was a little lightweight. He didn't have the gravitas of my dad. He mm-hmm. didn't remind me of my dad, and I didn't think he could carry the role at that point.
Yeah.
I think today he could. But Tim Allen, complete dick, not like my dad at
That's
all.
That's too bad. That's
yeah,
too bad.
It's all
so
right.
Here's a question. You've been writing for such a long time. You went to Notre Dame, you come out of Notre Dame, and you co-wrote a book called Out of Bounds, An Anecdotal History of Notre Dame Football.
Yes.
Are you a crazy Notre Dame football guy?
No, I am not.
And what was that all about then?
That was a commercial venture to capitalize on the fact that we had been given the mailing list to the Notre Dame football season ticket holders, and we wanted to tell the non-football stories. So those are all stories that the players tell one another. They are not stories of heroic exploits in the games.
I see.
They are locker room stories, funny stories, stories about road trips.
And did it work?
Anecdotes.
Did you sell a lot?
Yeah, we were the Sports Illustrated Book Club selection for 1 month, and we were featured a chapter in the Notre Dame football program. We sold out the first printing. And that led me, that started my way as a professional.
Yeah, and then eventually you were a publicist for one of the studios? Or what?
Well, I started as a publicist at Disney on Tron. That was my first assignment at Disney, was to explain computer graphics to the world.
And how did you decide to leave being a publicist, or how did you make that choice?
You just keep telling stories, Christine.
Yeah.
You know how it works. And so if you have story in your arsenal, or you are aware of stories, you know how to tell them, and express them, you will keep evolving in the world.
Yeah.
Because you're following your stories. Your stories are telling you.
Yeah, it's exhausting, isn't it?
Well, it can be. Everything's exhausting, isn't it?
True. It's so true.
Isn't
working in the garden exhausting? Life is going to go by 10 years from now. You may as well have something accomplished.
Yeah, exactly. So, and it was a great time to start at Disney because it was incredible creative ferment from the bottom up.
Yeah.
Because the top management was focused on building Epcot, which left the studio in complete upheaval and chaos, where the young people like Tim Burton and John Lasseter and all the young animators were just running amok.
That's cool, man. That's
running
great.
Running amok. And one of the things that we try to impress upon our clients today is you don't get the 30 years of prosperity that Disney has had ever since without that ferment at the beginning.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And yet organizations are not set up to allow that.
Anymore.
They're not. And so they're more and more it's about scaling and cutting costs. It's
innovation. Hold on, yeah. But do you think Walt Disney, he didn't intend for it to become that probably in terms of like that Wild West for a minute there, that running amok. I'm sure that was not his intent.
Well, it happened with Disney early on and Disney.
But it really wasn't early on. I mean, this is 20 years after Disney.
No, but for Disney, it was like in waves.
In
the 30s.
Well, it was crazy in the 20s and 30s.
Crazy.
Yeah, and it was actually the third because I think when Walt turned to theme parks, then, you know, the studio had to find its own way as far as animation and filmmaking.
Plus other studios are coming up.
Right.
So they got to stay in there.
Yeah, and then Walt was always willing. See, Walt was the exceptional chief executive. I mean, he wasn't chief executive. He was vice president of production or something or executive producer for the studio. But he was always willing to bet all the chips. And what he intended with Epcot was to put all the chips on the table as he had with Snow White. As he had with Disneyland, all the chips on the table to build a city in Florida.
Interesting.
He wanted to build a city because in the 1964 World's Fair, everybody was writing him blank checks.
Yeah.
The not-for-profits with UNICEF to make Small World.
So he bought up very small plots of land because he couldn't buy it all in one fell swoop, as I understand
it. Right, 28,000 acres.
He slowly but surely over a period of time he acquired and then he put it all together.
Right, but it wasn't the city. By that time, he had passed away, and what was built in Walt Disney World and Epcot really was not the city.
You say Epcot, I think like that's like the most outdated theme park. It's like so antiquated
and
now.
And had he lived to do it would not be outdated.
It would have been a living city. His whole idea is a living experiment, an experimental prototype. And Epcot was just a placeholder name. They would have come up with something better.
Yeah, totally.
So the fact is that, the organization was able to. There was a man named Ron Miller, and we used to make fun of Ron Miller. He was Walt's son-in-law. We used to make fun of him because he was a former football player, and I wasn't so bad about it because I respected athletes. But a lot of the animators and the artists, they're like, oh, he's a football player, and even Walt thought of him as a stud in the farm of making grandchildren because Walt couldn't have that many kids, so they had like 11 kids, Diane and Ron, but Ron more and more looks to me like a hero because he indulged people their mistakes. He let people screw around in the name of their art. He let things that didn't have any profitability. So Tim Burton was making Frankenweenie, a half-hour black and white film that cost $1 million or more, that was never going to get its money back. John Lasseter was making these experimental films that combine computers and hand-drawn animation with using Maurice Sendak characters because hand-drawn animators could never make all the cross-hatchings in a Maurice Sendak drawing. So they started to play with that, and Ron indulged the children. He indulged children. He knew that it was going to be a source of growth, and he never got credit for that. And one of the things I've actually had some conversations with some people at Disney is I hope to give Ron some credit while he's still around and is there to take it because he is he deserves a lot of credit for
is
what happened.
Is he retired now? Is he still with the company?
He hasn't been with the company for a while. I think they have a vineyard, and Diane died last fall in an accident. So it's just Ron as the patriarch of that family, but I think he deserves a lot of credit for what Michael Eisner took credit for. That the seeds were sown before Eisner got there. And you need both. You need the discipline and the structure to harvest those outcomes, but you need to lay the foundation.
Yeah. Hey, let me just real quick, I'm going to go back to your story and that you're friends with Joel Murray. I didn't understand when you said that Joel Murray was out with his brother Bill, they're golfing all weekend, and they didn't have a chance to talk. I thought the whole idea of golf is that all you do is bullshit.
Not about my thing. Not about my thing. They are in a competitive tournament, and they had to. They were talking about golf.
I see.
Yeah, okay, the Murrays are one of those people, I know, but it's like, I have a feeling Bill Murray takes golf really crazy seriously.
I see.
Like, he really likes to play golf, and that's what he's doing when he's playing golf.
They all take golf seriously, yeah. And if I remember correctly, Joel said that they had a game to defeat their opponents, and the game was to call attention to every random thing on the golf course.
I see.
So if there was a tree by the tee box, their game was to call attention to the tree on the idea that it would distract their opponent and pull their concentration to the tree so that they'd be hitting down the fairway and their opponents would be spraying left and right.
Okay, so let's move over and talk about your company, Big Story. You're the CEO yes. of this company. You've worked with a lot of different people. Part of this is your book, Game Changers, and where you take these games and you show companies how they can apply this improvisation to their business communication. So you've worked with companies like Skype, The Gap, Walt Disney, Gawker Media, NetApp, GE. You've worked with all these big companies.
Mm-hmm.
So what do you do, Mike? You approach the company, you say, hey, I got this thing. I had to come and spend the weekend with your employees.
That's exactly how we do it.
Is that right?
Yeah.
That rocks, man. And then they send you a check.
And they go, the check's already there usually by the time I hang up the phone. You know how it works.
Here's my PayPal account.
Fantastic. Come on now. Everybody should be in this business. Why aren't we all doing this?
How does this work?
No, it all works because invariably there's interest in storytelling. And almost equally as invariably, it's the wrong notion of storytelling for organizations.
Mm.
Because what happens in organizations when they have a linear concept of storytelling, beginning, middle, and end, I'm going to tell you a story and you're going to do something mm-hmm. as an employee or okay. a customer as okay. a result of me telling that story, that's a very limited notion of story because it doesn't give you a place in the story.
Right.
It's an attempt to manipulate you the way Hollywood will manipulate emotions with a story. Linear stories are great. I love telling stories. We all do. That's why we're here. However, for leaders in organizations, for brands that are looking to engage customers in a heavily mediated, social media-affected world, that is not sufficient.
The story has to pose questions so that there can become dialogue.
Exactly. It needs to be dialogue. And more than the story, we use game structure as story engines. You have to generate story at scale.
Yes.
And using game as a story engine is a way to invite participation because anybody can play a game, and a game scales from local to global. So one example, we're talking to the International Red Cross Red Crescent, and they are using journalists right now for their storytelling. So journalists have This is how a case study worked out, a scenario worked out in Ghana. So let's take that to Colombia because they have a similar problem with flooding. However, those stories are not sufficient because there's different context. Everything changes when you move a story from one context to another. And as opposed to, let's find the game that works. Let's find the set of practices. So we call it ERGO, E-R-G-O, mm-hmm. Environment, Roles, Guidelines, Objective. We use that game structure to look at situations that are either analogous to one another or can be compared to one another. So if an organization, for example, is having trouble in customer service, we'll look at the mean, okay, your net promoter score, which is their metric for customer service, a typical metric for customer services, which is how will your customers promote you after working with you and getting customer service. So if their net promoter score is low, and we will look at their average performance, how do they typically do it? And we'll call that a game. We'll say, okay, here's one game, and that's how you're handling things right now. Somewhere in the organization are the outliers. There are people that are doing exceptionally well. They're up in the high levels of the score, and they're performing at a level that the management wishes the entire company.
Yeah, the Malcolm Gladwell outliers. These guys are.
So we'll call that game B. So game A and game B. And then we'll have them work. We'll work with them to redesign the game to move it toward game B? What are the resources that are going to take? What is the difference between this game and this game? This is the inefficient game.
Now, you don't call this copying. You call this what? Taking ideas.
We call it redesigning
modeling.
The game. Yeah, it could be modeling, redesigning the game. It depends on who we're talking to always. But essentially, we're looking at games as story engines because you're playing a game right here on the mean, on the average, that is not generating good stories.
Mm-hmm.
The customers are not happy with you, and we know this from the data we're getting back. Some people are playing a better game. Let's look at these two things. So we will use improv games. We'll make them as visual as we can, as kinetic as we can. And we will let people experience these games. What does this look like? Well, there's a lot of confusion. There's language translation issues. The wrong people are fielding the calls.
Do you think the employees are happy to see you, or are the employees like, oh boy, here we go?
We always have a lot of fun.
Yeah.
The control freaks freak out.
Yeah.
If people are natural control freaks,
yeah,
it's not really for them. Because you have to give up a lot of control to improvise and to be
present.
In this model of co-creation because you're co-creating. If you're a control freak, you want to be the creator. You want to have the say.
Yeah.
And I think we passed a threshold in this country in particular, and as far as the world is concerned, when Colin Powell told a story to the world at the UN that had been scripted for him that said, there is an imminent threat to the United States from the country of Iraq and the yellow cake uranium. That was a fiction.
Wow.
That was a story that had been scripted.
Wow.
And the cost of inflicting that story on the American public has been incalculable.
Right.
And for me, that was it. That said, we need a new model.
That is so powerful, Mike. That is really interesting.
Thank you.
I just read your article that you wrote very recently in the Huffington Post about Donald Trump.
Oh, yes.
Now, that article is interesting. And you're talking about how he's pulling one over on the American public. Like there is a pawn and there's a shill. Or how does that?
A stall. Yeah, a stall for a pickpocket. Well, he's clowning, and he's doing it intuitively. He has a lot of game. He is very improvisational. He's working he's responding and adding, as
yes
the improvisers
anding.
Say. He's yes-anding. And he is he's putting the bell on the political cat. He's everybody. Everybody's a target. Today it was Hillary Clinton. Next week it'll be the Republicans. And, you know, There's a conceivable scenario where he gets elected president and then it all goes to shit, which may be the very best thing that could happen, is let's go into early Disney mode where it's just completely chaotic and it falls apart. It may be that Mitt Romney comes in. It may be, but someone's going to come in on the Republican side, my theory was in that article, and look like the voice of reason and a breath of fresh air relative to Trump.
Yeah.
You thought that would be Jeb Bush.
I thought it would be Jeb Bush. Jeb Bush is so incompetent that he may not even be able to fill that role. And so you see all these people lurking now. So Mitt Romney's out there somewhere just checking it out every day.
Yeah.
Al Gore has started to check it out on the Democratic side. I do believe it'll be Hillary. I don't know a lot about politics, but, you know, I think it'll be Hillary against Jeb Bush or Mitt Romney. And,
it's just what do you think of that? I mean, as long as we're doing on this road, Bernie Sanders, what do you...
I mean, I love Bernie Sanders. Bernie Sanders.
It seems like a lot of people that I know on Facebook or friends of mine like Bernie Sanders, and I think I would like him, but I really don't have any idea if he can get that Democratic nomination.
Well, he's
people
a
say
populist.
It's impossible.
He's a populist. Hillary's problem, as I understand it, and we've talked to people in the Clinton campaign on a number of fronts. Her problem is the public face. In private, everybody I know, and I just talked to Angelo Pizzo last week, who wrote Hoosiers and Rudy, mm-hmm, the screenwriter. Mm-hmm. He's got a movie coming out. I should get a plug in for him for his Texas football movie that's coming out in October.
Yeah.
A Texas football movie.
Texas
that's
football movie.
Science fiction.
Yeah, how about that? You might as well say it's a Martian outer space movie, huh? it's
but
redundant
he
as hell.
He says that Hillary's a wonderful woman.
He spent a little time with her because they did the premiere of Rudy at the White House.
Yeah.
And he was sitting right at a table adjacent to her, and she was sitting with all of her Arkansas buddies, like the Bloodworth Thomasons. And, and he said she was just having a great time, a big raucous laugh, completely let her guard down.
I've heard that about her, too. I've heard that she's incredibly compassionate and a really great person.
And
it's just that since she's been in politics her whole life, she doesn't know how
to be normal. But her public persona is like, I think that it's like, I want to like her.
Right.
but I don't like her. I don't dislike her, and I like her politics, and I'm perfectly willing to vote for her because I think it's ridiculous that we have to like people.
Right.
But it is a problem. That's what you're saying. It's like she comes off as cold or...
Well, she's calculated because that's she's had to be with Bill. She didn't, she had to be the balancing act to Bill, who was exuberant and intuitive and all of these things that made him a good politician, instantly relatable to people at every level. Grabbed the saxophone. It didn't matter. Bill could connect. He's a super talented.
He can connect with my pants anytime. Hey, you know what I'm saying?
There you go. Well, you weren't the only one, darling, apparently. So
yeah, I think that Bill Clinton is the kind of guy people will literally forgive him almost anything.
Right.
Yeah.
And it's like people who were like, this is outrageous. He had sex with an intern. And I'm like, well, what the fuck? Yeah, like we didn't fuck. It was insulting to the American public. Like we didn't know that.
Yeah.
But what are we supposed to be? Outraged? We knew exactly who this guy was. He's our crazy uncle, but he's brilliant. So let him balance the budget.
Right.
You know?
Right, right. So I think they were always a team. And I think the question is whether Hillary can open up and make herself vulnerable in a way that people will appreciate. And the really gutsy move would be to be vulnerable about her relationship with Bill. I mean, that would be the thing, is to put him on the sacrificial altar and go, Bill, it's your time to bear the weight of this.
Wow.
And I'm going to slice and dice you a little bit here, pal, and it's going to hurt.
That would be interesting.
And we're going to keep the marriage together because that's what we do. But, dude, I have to claim my pain.
I'd like to hear that story.
Well, everybody would. And then everybody's going to relate. And she also, as I understand it, she's got a trouble with African-American women. And I think a little bit of that is show your soul. Show your soul, sister. Like, we're ready. And I think we could use a woman president. She's as competent until Elizabeth Warren comes along and gets more seasoning. Nobody knows international diplomacy better. You know, if you really look at the track record, and they try to make a big deal out of Benghazi, but Jesus, look at what Reagan gave up during his... I mean, Reagan just let everybody was running bombs into embassies and people...
Benghazi was an attack on us. It wasn't us.
Right.
They tried to kill people, and they killed people. It happens, all the time, unfortunately.
Yeah. And the best you can do is contain it. And I think, the Obama administration, she was part of that. My feeling is, wow, what an amazing job to pick up the shit show that was left then.
Yeah, exactly.
And put it back where it is.
Absolutely.
It's amazing.
Absolutely.
Can I ask you, what do you think of this idea that she might end up being the nominee just because she has so many chits, she has so many markers out there? It reminds me of Mondale in 1984. Mondale was a great guy who was uninspiring, but it was, and you were like, I remember, and we were like, this is the guy you're going to put up against Ronald Reagan, this the dullest dishwater man in the world, but it was his time. Everybody in the Democratic Party owed him, and it was time for him to get an image. Bob Dole, same thing. It was his time. There was no fucking way Bob Dole was going to beat Clinton, but he was owed by everybody in the Republican Party. It was his chance. It was his turn to be the nominee. And I feel like it's like that with Hillary. It's like you can't stop her from being the nominee. I don't even want to, but it's like you can't stop her.
Right. The war chest is too deep. The favors are too deep. The Renaissance weekends, the Clinton Global Initiative, those have been running for 20 years. Mm. And those are all favors being accumulated to be paid back at the appropriate time.
Mike Bonifer, you're really interesting. You could talk about a lot of subjects, can't you?
I have a lot of stories.
You got a lot of stories.
Yes,
I know you do. Hey, listen, you want to tell one more and play some Shotgun Storyworthy?
Sure.
Music can only mean one thing. It's time for Shotgun Storyworthy.
The game where our storyteller spins the storyworthy wheel of truth and tells a true one-minute story about the topic it lands on.
So everybody, say it with me.
Spin that wheel!
Accidents. So I have 1 minute?
Yep.
So we had a brand new car, an Oldsmobile Vista Cruiser, the kind that had the glass on top, and you could look through and see the sky, and it was the family's pride. And my father let me drive it to go into town, and in the town where I grew up, Jasper, Indiana, we did a thing called the Whip, which is basically you drive around the courthouse, and then you drive out to the edge of town and drive around Jerry's restaurant, and then you drive back around the courthouse. And that is all you do, except maybe you park at Jerry's for some French fries. So my friend Gary Stratman and I were parked at Jerry's for some French fries, and there's a lot of cars coming around on the whip. You know, there's just cars circling constantly. So Stratman is looking, and it's time for us to get back in the circle and get back in the whip. And he's looking, and we get a space, and he goes, hit it. And I back up, and I turn the wheel as hard as I can, and the car basically climbs up on the car next to it.
Yeah.
And we're sitting there, and my buddy could not quit laughing. But my father, after falling off all those horses and having all the reprobate horses, he forgave me.
Oh, that's a great story. I'm just at 1 minute long. Wow, that's really funny. The whip. That's hilarious.
Thank you. It was fun.
Wow, that was excellent. Thank you
Stratman
so much.
Stratman laughing at me the way he did. He thought it was hilarious. Here I had wrecked the family car, and he's like, oh.
Yeah, well, it is very funny. Okay. Hey, listen, man, thank you again so much for coming.
Thank
this
you
has
both.
Been a lot of fun,
thank
man.
Thank you both. I
absolutely.
Yeah,
a lot of fun.
Awesome.
I want to thank everybody here at Sideshow Network, including Maria Spertolozzi. Thanks, Maria. And Sean Merrick, of course. There's Tad Rowe over there. We don't see him a lot, do we, Hannes?
Oh, my God, he rode a horse in.
How about
God,
that?
It's a bad horse.
And on behalf of John Thomas Griffith, you know, he wrote the theme song to Storyworthy, Follow Me.
Really? What was the name of his band?
What is his band? Cowboy Mouth. That is his
I'm
band.
I'm saying Cowboy Mouth. Get it?
Cowboy Mouth. Oh, nice cowboy. Together. Got it.
Thanks for paying attention, Christine. Thank you.
And on behalf of our storyteller tonight, Mike Bonifer, again, thank you so much for coming.
Yes, thank you.
And on behalf of you, Hannes Finney, my dear friend and co-host, my name is Christine Blackburn, saying, make it a story worthy of
you.
Thanks for joining us on the Storyworthy Podcast. We'll be back next week with all new stories. Subscribe to Storyworthy on iTunes and visit the Storyworthy website at storyworthypodcast.com.
Jesse Sturchness.
That bitch owes me
$10. This is how we market the book.
I'm going to say it again. Oh, God. Okay. This is one of those. Sturchness. Okay, here we go.
Sternschuss.
All right. He also has a brand new book out called Control Shift. I knew it.
The shift is messing
all right,
you up.
All right. All right. He also has a new book out that he... No. He also has a new book out called Control Shift. Okay. He also has a new book... Honest, don't look at me.
I'm not looking at you.
He also has a new...
That made no fucking sense whatsoever. No fucking sense at all.